Good morning. Good to see you all this morning. Today we're looking at another of the promises of God as our series continues, Yes and Amen, the promises of God, and working through a different promise each week we will unpack. But we're going to start, first of all, in order to keep us awake and engaged, we'll start with a video. And you can tell by the inflection of my voice that encourages a cheer. How well trained we all are. Isn't that wonderful? Okay, can I ask my wonderful assistant, please?
Hey, line up. Line up. Everybody line up. We're about to race. Everybody line up. Shoulder to shoulder. Take off your backpacks. Basketball, line up. We're about to race. Hey, we are racing for a $100 bill. The winner of this race will take this. A $100 bill. Before I say go, I'm going to make a couple statements. If those statements apply to you, I want you to take two steps forward. If those statements don't apply to you, I want you to stay right where you're at. Take two steps forward if both of your parents are still married. Take two steps forward if you grew up with a father figure in the home. Take two steps forward if you had access to a private education. Take two steps forward if you had access to a free tutor growing up. Take two steps forward if you've never had to worry about your cell phone being shut off. Take two steps forward if you've never had to help mom or dad with the bills. Take two steps forward if it wasn't because of your athletic ability, you don't have to pay for college. Take two steps forward if you never wondered where your next meal was going to come from. I want you guys up here in the front just to turn around and look. Every statement I've made has nothing to do with anything any of you have done. Has nothing to do with decisions you've made. Everything I have said has nothing to do with what you've done. We all know these people up here have a better opportunity to win this $100. Does that mean these people back here can't race? No. We would be foolish to not realize we've been given more opportunity. We don't want to recognize that we've been given a head start. But the reality is we have. Now, there's no excuse. They still got to run their race. You still got to run your race.
Hands up who liked that video. It's quite upsetting, isn't it? A little bit. I found it quite upsetting. I found it quite difficult. Particularly the ones who are standing at the back when he says, turn around. I'm like, well, hang on. That's not fair. It's true, though, isn't it? We all know it. We all know that this is how life is set. This is how things have been made. Could you go ahead with the first slide, please? You see, there's a promise in Philippians that we're going to look at today, and here it is on the screen. I rejoice greatly in the Lord that at last you renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned, but you had no opportunity to show it. I am not saying this because I am in need, for I've learned to be content in whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do all this through him who gives me strength. Yet it was good of you to share in my troubles. You see, we can recognize this race, this unequal race. But here's the thing. We recognize that some people will race from further back. Some carry weights that others don't carry. The world says, this is the rules. Get to the front. Regardless. That is the unspoken message broadcast throughout our culture. Get to the front. You're in a race. You better run. But here's the thing. Jesus says, go. You see, the gospel does not deny unequal starting positions. It doesn't pretend that the race is fair. Jesus doesn't swap the lanes around, the lane assignments, and move people into different places. Jesus does something much, much more radical than that. Jesus says, is this the race? Is this the race? Are you sure? Jesus wants to ask much bigger questions about what we decide that our lives have been. So here's the question, your first question. And to give you a hint, there's going to be a few questions, Nigel. Now, if I don't see smoke coming off your pencil as you write these down, as you furiously knot that brow to think of your own answers, Fiona, sharp elbows. What are you running towards? Or perhaps, what are you running from? Because the answer will shape not just what you achieve, but who you become. How you see the person next to you and whether the world feels like a home or an arena of competition. I believe that this promise is huge. You see, the world's promise is that you can have security, that you can have worth, that you can have contentment through finite resources. But more than that, that the entire system continually assumes lack as its starting point. You see, things have been set in such a way that you must believe that you are not enough. You must become enough. You must do something. You must achieve something. You lack enough status or security or worth in yourself and who you are. So therefore, you must gain it in order to be something more than you are. There is an inherent drive deep down within us that we want to be more than we are, that somehow there is this message that is being broadcast continually, that we receive continually in so many different ways. So life is reduced. We are reduced from participants to consumers and competitors. Life becomes about acquisition, about getting stuff. And the next stuff you get will be the best stuff because that stuff will make you happier until that stuff begins to get a little bit old or you see someone else with slightly better stuff, which makes your stuff feel slightly less nice. And all of a sudden, what you have doesn't seem enough stuff. Perhaps you've got enough stuff, but you want to protect your stuff, so you need a cushion. The horizon gradually narrows to become, your life becomes defined by securing, protecting and achieving. Not only does this make our lives smaller, it doesn't work. Security remains provisional. Only if you have those things can you feel content. Only if the housing market's okay will you sleep at night. Only if our contentment remains temporary in this condition of a race. Now, it will shock you to know, as it always does, that Philippians 4 is based on Philippians 3. You see, he's going somewhere. Keep your applause to the end, please. We've talked about this. We've had a whole thing in house group about standing ovations. I insisted no, but Dan. Philippians 3 underlies the point that Paul is making, lies in Philippians 3. We'll get there, and we're going to go through this little step by step. For I have told you, how often I have told you before, and now tell you again, even with tears, that many live as enemies of the cross of Christ. Their destiny is destruction, and their God is their stomach. And their glory is their shame. Their mind is set on earthly things. This isn't just a condemnation of bad people. This is a diagnostic. This is somebody diagnosing a problem that he's about to offer a solution for. Notice that. In the Christian world, we tend to think that we've given someone a prophetic word when we've offered a diagnosis. Jesus never offered a diagnosis that he didn't also provide a cure for. Otherwise, you've just given someone a problem. When God gives you a sense of a diagnosis for someone, pray then that he would also give you something to provide for them as well. You see, hunger for these people has become God. Hunger for status, hunger for achievement. We'll break it down and see what Paul built on. But identity ultimately becomes built on something that can't hold it. You see, finite things were never designed to carry infinite weight. It's not that we love the wrong things. It's that we ask the wrong things to be the most important. It's that we ask our career, our marriage, our identity, our ministry. We ask our profile. We ask our bank account. We ask our home. We ask our status in the community or in any given context. We ask those things to be the thing. When we want anything but God, we want anything but God to be everything. We set ourselves up to fail. So this all begins. I happened to start a Bible plan recently, looking for kind of a bit of a structure to my Bible reading, and I'm going through kind of one of those plans, the Bible in 2 years it is. So we started Genesis and Matthew, and you kind of walk through. And I came as I was beginning to consider this a few weeks ago, this topic. I came across Genesis 3. And in Genesis 3, we see, I believe, exactly the same thing at work in Eve as I discern in what Paul describes in Philippians 3. I believe these two things are mirror images of each other. And the question I asked was, how does a person who has everything come to believe, as Eve did, that they have nothing? How is it that Eve, walking in unbroken fellowship and closeness with God, becomes convinced to feel the need to desire something more? How can that be? The ideal picture of Genesis is that humanity existing in its ideal state in relationship with God was unbroken fellowship for eternity. And yet, somehow, what is it in human nature? And I was really wrestling with this as I read, and as I was thinking about it, and kind of, because you know, when you read the Bible, you're meant to think about it. And I know, somebody that was scandalized, somebody there. No. And as I considered, how is it that we can be so easily suggested to looking for more? And then I began to realize that she's not offered something genuinely new. What happens in Philippians 3, underpinning Philippians 4, in Genesis 3, 1 to 5, we see the strategy of the enemy is that he introduces comparative dissatisfaction. Did God really say? Has God really said this? He begins to undermine what it is that she already has. Before the desire, why does Eve begin to desire? It wasn't desire that was the problem. It was the enemy made Eve believe she lacked something by introducing three steps to what she had and held. Before desire comes lack. Instead of framing Eve as wanting more, she's framed as perceiving deficiency where none exists. Somehow what she has isn't enough or there could be more. Before the fruit can appear desirable, Eve must be persuaded that she has what she already has is insufficient. So it's a shift of perception. This apple that he presents to Eve is good for food. That's physically good. It is a delight to the eyes. It's aesthetically pleasing. It's got an aesthetic, as they say on the social medias, if you're into that. It looks nice. It's appealing to us. It has beauty about it. And it is desirable to make one wise. Identity. It is physically appealing. It is aesthetically pleasing. And it offers something of an improvement to her identity. None of which were broken. None of which were lacking in any way. Eve wasn't hungry. The fullness was already given to her by God. She wasn't ignorant. But the serpent suggested she had a lack because she wasn't like God. She wasn't deprived in any way, but this lack is perceived. This results in her grasping the fruit offered. Nothing that she didn't already possess, but still, the introduction that you lack something is enough to make her drive towards, and then she begins to desire for more. You will be like God is the promise that's attached. Yet she already bore the image of God. She grasps the copy and loses the original. She believes the lie, and then as a result, shame introduces insecurity into the relationship with God. Hide, cover ourselves in case he sees us. Act like everything's okay. From this moment, the human project becomes the anxious management of lack introduced by a lie. And all the pages after, you see, the difficulty is, well, Philippians 3 has a Philippians 4. Genesis 3 isn't going to stop until Malachi. The story of human falling short, the story of human's desire to move away from lack, of not being enough, of striving for something more than God will permit us to have, is the story that resonates through the rest of the pages of the Old Testament, broken only by those who would try and live faithful lives in obedience to God occasionally, but even they find it difficult to do well. Sin's consistent strategy, he reframes before he destroys. He makes the good you have appear insufficient. He makes the forbidden appear necessary. And he makes life-limiting, horizon-constricting, and worth-reducing conditions for your life. What is it that you feel you lack in your life? Not what do you want. What is it that your flesh deep down inside insists must be filled? Something that you never say out loud to anyone, but it drives you deep down inside. Because the answer to that question, Nigel, what do you lack, will tell you what is functionally governing your life. Desire itself isn't the problem. It's when desire is redirected by the lie that this will make you better, this will make you more, this is the answer for you. So if the human story since Eden has been the anxious management of introduced lack, this idea that you're not enough, you don't have enough, then Paul is remarkable because he doesn't escape that loss. He no longer interprets that as everything that life is about. Paul does experience loss, but he just doesn't derive meaning from it. It doesn't mean that then he is bad because he is shipwrecked, because he is beaten, because he has been disappointed in his ministry. It doesn't mean he's a failure. You see, Paul is consistently surrounded by people in the culture that he's in. Now, this book would have been written later than Corinthians was written. In Corinthians, they have these incredible people called super apostles. And I know what you're thinking. No, I'm not. Stop it. No. That was horrible. Sorry. The sort of people who will have business cards, you know, rather than anointings, insist that you call them by their office rather than having a name. You know, you see, Paul was confronted and people had infiltrated the church in Corinth and had told people, Paul doesn't seem very good, does he? Is that Paul? That small guy who can't see anything. He's stumbling around there. You think you're following him? Are you sure you want to listen to him? Because we've been to rhetorical school in the Mediterranean. We've been taught by the best argument people who teach how to argue well and how to build a case. We've been trained in all the ways of Greek rhetoric in ways to gain power and influence and status. And him? You're listening to him? Who's he? This is the very thing that Paul begins to embrace as his identity. Yes, I am not enough. I haven't got time to tell you all the illustrations that are popping into my head, so I'll stick to my notes because there is a secret, you see, to this grand brokenness introduced through the narrative of human history and their interactions with God in the pages of the Old Testament. There is a secret that a man in a prison cell, beaten, hungry, uncertain, and dependent. By every working metric, the man is a failure. He has no reputation to speak of. And if he does, nobody cares. Or the people that do are so small and few in number that they are negligible. You see, the wholeness of this diagnosis that he begins to realize is written in Philippians 3, 4 to 7. And it says, indeed, if others have reason for confidence in their own efforts, I have even more. I could make these arguments to these super apostles. I was circumcised when I was 8 days old. I am a pure-blooded citizen of Israel and a member of the tribe of Benjamin, a real Hebrew if there ever was one. I was a member of the Pharisees who demand the strictest obedience to Jewish law. I was so zealous that I harshly persecuted the church. As for righteousness, I obeyed the law without fault. I once thought these things were valuable. Fill in the blank for us today. What is it that we seek to achieve or we admire in the lives of other people? What achievements is it that they gain that you think, if I could just have, then I would be? The mistake made by the younger son of the two lost sons that we see in the parable in Luke. I have done, therefore I am. You see, this list is not a list that is negligible or not important. It has worth in itself. But now, he says, I consider them worthless because of what Christ has done. Paul, having remained in Jesus, the Jesus that knocked him off his horse, that made him blind, that as he was traveling towards Emmaus, or not Emmaus, as he was traveling and he's knocked down, he's blinded by the presence of this light that he didn't recognize and he couldn't identify. But it says, I am him who you were persecuting. His whole world is reorientated around this experience, about this moment. But it isn't just about the momentary encounter. It's about his consistent commitment to that encounter afterwards. We may have met Jesus, but sometimes, in the same way that as we look at this switch and this light fitting, there are leads that run to that behind this. You'll have pipes in your house that run to your radiators that are boxed away and tidied away so that things look nice. In the same way, I do wonder this morning as we were in worship, I felt a sense that sometimes I wonder, yes, you have Jesus in your life. Yes, you're saved. Yes, you're a Christian. Yes, tick all the boxes, baptized, believing, and that's brilliant, and that is not nothing at all, believe me. But I wonder, to what extent have we boxed him away and kept him in comfortable places that when it comes to this Jesus that Paul is about to tell us about, I wonder, is he still this to us? When Paul says, I have learned, he's not saying, I sat in a classroom and I've been given information that I now understand. I did a test to prove that I know it, and now I've got the certificate. It is the language used of apprenticeship, of learning through experience, of learning through the process of being taught practically. He has learned through hunger, through loss, through imprisonment. The credentials he had were real. The achievements were real. They were incredible by any standard. But the comparison now to Jesus changed everything. Now, gentle Christian, please prepare yourselves, because I know in Warwickshire we're a very sensitive and posh lot. I know, it's okay, I can see. So therefore, please forgive me when I say there is a sweary coming. We would say in Scotland, a sweary. Because Paul's word here, I count them as nothing, is actually pretty strong in Greek skubala, meaning, yes, thank you, Ian, dung, waste. It is really strong, a really, really strong word. Now, it's not evil. But what it means it is completely nothing in comparison. This was everything that I could have aimed for in life that would give me what I needed and wanted. But now, in light, this comparison of the thing that I've discovered has surpassing value. Huper echon in Greek. Surpassing value. Everything compared to this. But remember I said, the comparison that we make that makes what we have somehow now not seem enough. It's kind of like that. In the way that you've got your phone, you're happy with your phone, you've had your Nokia 3310 for 154 years and it's done you fine. You're perfectly content with it and you don't need anything else. But then someone puts something else in your hand. You go, ooh, this does things that I don't need in my life, but it's fun. And then you pick up your Nokia again, and you like it still, but it's not quite the same anymore, is it? We have that capacity to be slightly dissatisfied by what was enough when we are presented with something of surpassing value. It's kind of like that. Paul doesn't sit down and rationally conclude that his credentials are worth less than Jesus, so I think I'll go with Jesus. It's not even close to a comparison. He encounters something of such surpassing value that the recategorization happens automatically. That was nothing. Nothing. So radical was his encounter with the person of Jesus Christ. The everyday tragedy is that most people spend their lives defending the old phone because they've never held the new one long enough to feel the difference. Have we beheld Jesus long enough to see the difference? Have we taken him out from the comfortable corner of an accessory to become the center of all that we do? You see, this is the full opposite of Eve's story. Where Eve was full and complete, she perceived lack, which made her grasp. Paul has Christ and realizes this is more than enough. And so, in doing so, it makes him let go. All of a sudden, all these things that everyone else is pushing for, trying to achieve, trying to gain, driven to apprehend, he can stand back and say, it's nothing. What you're building everything on, what you're valuing, what you're protecting, what you derive your security and your confidence from, it's nothing. The serpent says, what you have is not enough, grasp for more. Paul says, I found the one thing that is actually enough, and now I am free. He doesn't stop desiring, because desire in itself is good if it is directed at the right thing. His desire finally found its true object, the only thing, the only something that can be everything, and that is Jesus. That is Jesus. I feel like in my life, this is a lesson I need to keep learning. Yes, I learned it when I came to the foot of the cross at the initial moment of my salvation, when I came to acknowledge in a broken way, as C.S. Lewis described himself, the most reluctant convert in all of England. I had to grudgingly give in and admit that God was God. I was the most on-the-fence convert, perhaps, in Northern Ireland at the time. I was like, I don't know, maybe. I don't know. I had no other choices left, really. And really, genuinely, I gave it as much intent as trying something for the first time. I was like, yeah, I'll give it a go. That's all, not because I devalued it, not because I wasn't knocked off my feet, but because it's all I could give. Because everything else I had tried had turned out to be dangerous or disappointing or insufficient. Harmful, actively, and abusive in some cases. So I'll try it, but I reserve the right. Sneak out the back door if it turns out to be not a nightmare. But God met me there. Slide 7, please. Where are we? Are we on track? Yep, next one again. So, read the context then. Brought low and abounding. Hunger and plenty. Need and abundance. The things that Paul goes through, the things that he does, the experience of his life, all these different conditions that he describes in the promise leading up to that incredible sentence which represents the promise. Whatever has happened in the course of my life, whatever I have gone through, in light of this revelation of the surpassing value of Jesus Christ, now the object of my desire, everything, all things that I live and go through, I can do them. Not I can win everything, not I can get everything, but I can face anything. And it doesn't defy me. It doesn't make me any more than Jesus encountering me has already made me. Only in him am I enough. Only in him do I have enough. Only in him can I be satisfied that it is enough. So then when those other things may come into my life, I can enjoy them for what they are without being defined by them, without being owned by them, without being reduced to loving them. Everything that you can experience. Why? Not because he's powerful, but because he is held by God, because he has placed his trust in Jesus. I noticed with joy as I was thinking these things through that Paul Hudson came to preach, and in Hebrews 13, he led us to a couple of verses. Keep your lives, it said in that, free from the love of money. Okay, we're on board, fairly comfortable with that concept as Christians. Yeah, we know we're not meant to do that. Okay. Why? Hebrews 13:5. Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have. Because God has said, never will I leave you and never will I forsake you. When nothing finite is ultimate anymore, then people next to you won't be the competition because you're not playing on even the same playing field. You've heard it said that people spend their lives climbing the ladder only to realize that the ladder was on the wrong wall all along. When they got to the top, they looked around and realized that they didn't want to be there. There's a line that I included in this that everyone misses. It is the line at the very end of the promise. Nevertheless, it was kind of you to share in my trouble. So free are the communities that Paul has planted from the need to look after their own needs in their own bank account, in their own cities and towns, that they could send him gifts, that they could share the resources that they had with open hearts. You see, if our identity is secure, we can be abundantly generous. Then others are no longer a threat to us. We're not, when we go into work, in a competition, because what Jesus has done in our lives means that we have enough. So therefore, we will serve for a different motivation. We will walk in a different way. We will do all the good we can to as many as we can in every way we can, because we serve a different God. This is the Jesus I want to remind you of today. So we go back to the unequal lanes then. We go back to, thank you, the race and the place that we're planted. We realize the most dangerous person in the race is the one who is no longer trying to become enough, but they can simply participate for the joy. Jesus has called us to have a life and life more abundantly, not squeezed into lanes of a race, but to be able to take a step back from that and enjoy living in community with others, that we see their needs in parallel to our own, not in competition to our own. You see, sin is not just about disobedience. It is believing that you lack what you already have been given. The gospel is not just about forgiveness. It is the restoration of our sight. We can open our eyes and see that life all along was about God and his planting and provision for us in life, that we could participate in the creation that we've been planted in together, that we live full lives, well and filled with joy. Is this the Jesus that you serve? Can I ask Chris and Rebecca, my two servants in the house of the Lord, to come and hand out communion? We're going to share communion together this morning. And as we do, I want us to lift our eyes and turn them upon Jesus. Do you want to give me a hand? Thank you. Have you got a song already? You do. Just what we're going to do is we're going to pass you out these emblems, the bread and the wine. And as we do so, hold on to it together. And then we're going to take it together at the end when I say, okay, I'll give you good, clear instructions so there won't be any confusion. Don't worry. You'll not be like unsure when to go or what to go for. Go ahead, take them right now. Come on, come on. I don't know what they were waiting for there, honestly. We're waiting for a starting pistol. No, take your time, honestly. You take. There you go. Just as we take these pieces then. This message is about Jesus. Jesus in a way that he should never not have been. But it's so easy. With Jesus, we don't need to win. We don't need others to lose. We don't interpret life as scarcity. We don't have to be the most driven. And we can be the most content. We can become a community again. We can, by our example and how we treat people then, become stars set in the midst of the darkness, that our lives become this bright outshining of hope. The question is not whether what you're aiming for is a bad thing. It's about whether it can carry the weight that you want it to carry, whether it can survive in hunger and in plenty. When markets collapse, when bank accounts are emptied, when war and chaos ravage the lands in which we live, when days come where our security is stripped away, is what you're building your life in enough to take that weight? Because it is only in Jesus that we can find enough. I don't know where you are in your spiritual condition today. I don't know how you answer these questions, but I know and I recognize and realize that even though I've walked with Jesus, now, only recently able to say longer than I didn't, a couple of decades, it still doesn't mean I don't need to learn the lesson of how central have I allowed him to be and have I kept him? How much am I still able? You see, it's really easy to say, yes, Jesus is most important when you don't have anything else. Isn't it? It's like saying, Jesus, I'll die for you. That's a really easy promise to make when it's very unlikely, really, you're going to face stubbing your toe in the name of the kingdom. It's dramatic, but it's not terribly likely. Thank you. Can I have some? Is that all right? Thank you. Rebecca didn't let me have any there. Sorry. Thank you. Yep, I think Phil needs to be a Christian. Do you want to come to know Jesus? Yep. And over there as well, over there as well. I'm terribly sorry. I don't know why they hate you. I don't know what you did to Rebecca, but... Even though I've been walking with Jesus on the road for a while, even though I've served him for a while in different capacities, even though I've done different things in different places, I still recognize that as you walk through life and begin to gain more things, as you achieve more things, as you do more things, those things begin to demand your attention and maintenance. But Jesus, on the night that he was betrayed, took bread as he sat with his friends. This Jesus who had proclaimed to the crowds, "I am the bread of life. Only I will satisfy the source of sustenance for you. The one who will feed your soul." That Jesus who never flinched from the last and the least and the lost, that Jesus planted in a backwater town in the middle of nowhere, far from the metropolitan centers of power and influence, to serve in the dusty and the dirty and the forgotten parts of the region of the Roman Empire. That Jesus, whose feet kicked up the dust in Nazareth, said, "This is my body." As we look at this bread, this body represented by this bread that Jesus then gave, that we might take it and share it indiscriminately, hospitably welcoming all who would be hungry, all who would be thirsty, all who have any need in their life to say, "Come, join at the table." They took that bread together and they ate it. You take the bread. "This is my body, which will be broken for you." This body of invitation. This body who sustained all things, who held together the fabric of existence by his very being. This Jesus, who at the center of all things offered himself as a sacrifice on behalf of humanity in order to open the door of invitation again. Do this in remembrance of me. Jesus, as we remember you this morning, we choose to take you out of the comfortable boxed-in sections that we have perhaps limited you to have as a nice accessory in the corner, but never too intrusive in the rest of our priorities. In the same way, he took the cup as he sat among friends and enemies alike, said, "This cup is a symbol of the blood of the new covenant. This blood that will be poured out, this blood symbolizing throughout ages gone by, the means of substitution and sacrifice in order to provide a right way with God, that dealt with sinful condition and cost. Take this cup also. My blood that is given for you. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. And as we proclaim his death, we proclaim the significance of a Savior who paid the price that all humanity could have the option, if they so chose, to say, Jesus, would you come and be the Lord of my life? Can I ask you to stand with me this morning? As we stand to worship, as we stand to turn our hearts towards you, before we sing the song, I want to ask you to set the direction of your heart. I don't care if you've been a Christian for 5 minutes or for 50 years. Would you set your sail this morning? That if perhaps you have lost sight of the all-surpassing value that gives you everything you could possibly ever need, that no other relationship, no other encounter, no other achievement will ever be able to compare to. Does it have the right place? Is it in your foundation? Or is it sitting like a Christmas tree brought out once a year for decoration? A nice to have, but not an essential. I wonder, can you sing this morning in the community of Jesus? Perhaps make yourself available to him again. It's not becoming saved again. It's not being rescued, but it is reminding ourselves. Us who have the capacity within our hearts to wander. Jesus, would you be the center? Would you help us to turn our eyes upon Jesus? To put you once again at the center of our faith. We push aside disappointment. We push aside disillusionment. We push aside all the other things that hijack our perspective. We ask Jesus, be the center. In Jesus' name.